Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Board of Public Works, August 10th, 2011. Nancy Kopp is on her way. In other words, as you looked up here, expected to see three people? No. The Board of Public Works has not been fallen victim to yet another round of budget cuts. We are still a three-member board, and Treasurer Kopp is en route back from out of town, and so because of flight delays and storms and weather and things of that nature, her connections have been pushed back. So this is what we're going to do. We're going to go ahead and do the agenda. If there are items that require some greater consideration than all three votes, I'm going to ask for your permission to hold those until she gets here, until the treasurer gets here, Mr. Comptroller. And we could do a jump ball in the middle of the room. And that way we get everybody else back to work, you know, on the matters where we might have questions. And so, anyway, I know that we also have Ted Mack, Chair of the Maryland Commission on African American History and Culture, is here with us today. Dr. Joni Jones, Executive Director of the Maryland Commission on African American History and Culture, and the Banneker Douglas Museum, one of the longest titles in all of public service. But let me begin by asking the Comptroller if he has any opening thoughts, comments.
Thank you, Governor. I turned on the TV set on Sunday morning, and there on one of the national shows with Christine
Amanpour,
yes, who's kind of the Dan Rather of today, was Governor O'Malley, and I just wanted to compliment you. I thought you did an excellent job.
Thank you.
The state was proud of you.
Let me point out, it was just my matter of personal privilege. Les Mike Miller thinks I was out of town for that. They taped 30 minutes down the road, so I was back in Maryland by 9:20. Thank you.
Yeah, I get little notes from the Senate President, too. But let me just comment that what a difference 2 weeks makes. We've gone pretty much 180 degrees since we had our very successful bond sale under the leadership of the Treasurer. And now we're meeting in the extraordinary aftermath of the downgrading of the credit rating of the United States of America. First time it happened since 1917, which I believe is the year they began these ratings. In Maryland, our own credit rating was put on a watch list. We were assigned a negative outlook for absolutely no fault of our own, other than the scope of our relationship with the federal government. Our state, which is taking extraordinary steps and at times taking extraordinary sacrifices under the leadership of Governor O'Malley to keep its fiscal house in order, now could possibly lose our own AAA credit rating solely because of that involvement by the federal government. I think it's important to note that while they hold enormous influence, Standard & Poor's and the other two rating agencies are far from infallible. These are the same analysts that rubber stamp AAA ratings on mortgage-backed securities, collateralized debt obligations, and other risky strategies which eventually brought down the nation's housing market and our economy. And there's considerable evidence that the assumptions and methodology used by this particular ratings agency in arriving at the conclusion to downgrade the United States of America was unforgivably sloppy and unbecoming of an institution which holds such sway over our nation's economy and financial markets. How do you make a $2 trillion mistake and use that to downgrade the United States of America, damages the country, damages our fiscal reputation, damages our global leadership, potentially raises interest rates for consumers, interest rates and costs of borrowing for state and local entities, lose trillions of dollars of wealth in the stock market, and get up the next day and look yourself in the mirror. And this $2 trillion mistake was caught by a third-level analyst after about a half hour's look at their press release on Friday. That notwithstanding, I think the bigger issue is not how we feel about who wrote the report, but what's actually in the report. And in the report, there was a searing indictment of our nation's institutions of government, the potential of our nation's leaders to put aside their partisan and philosophical differences for the sake of the national interest. After watching Congress embarrass our country before a global audience during the debt ceiling debate, it's hard to argue with S&P's conclusion, and I quote from their downgrading statement, "The political brinksmanship of recent months highlights what we see as America's governance and policymaking becoming less stable, less effective, less predictable than what we previously believed." And continuing, quote, "the statutory debt ceiling and the threat of default have become political bargaining chips in the debate over fiscal policy." Now, that's quite a statement about a system of government that's endured a tremendous amount, overcome great challenges. As a result of the toxic partisanship that has poisoned our political discourse and the fact that our citizens have lost, many of them, what little they have, I think it's a wake-up call for all of us in public service. I think it's time to put down the partisan brickbats, put country above party. Now, more than ever, we need economic statesmen. It's time to finally come together to responsibly rein in excessive spending, rein in excessive debate, get our fiscal houses in order. It's time that both parties at all levels of government rededicate ourselves to rebuilding an economy that is powered by the innovation and entrepreneurship of the private sector and not by the largesse of the federal government. In other words, it's time for our leaders in Washington to grow up, and it's time for the rest of us to keep our eye on the ball. Then and only then will we be able to get back to providing the high-quality services that our taxpayers deserve and make the investments in the priorities that we share. Thank you, Governor.
Thank you, Mr. Comptroller. Okay, shall we go now to the Secretary's agenda?
Thank you, Governor. Good morning, Governor, Mr. Comptroller. We have 24 items on the Secretary's agenda. There's one report of an emergency procurement. We are withdrawing item 13. We're prepared for questions you may have. Item 19 is the African American Historic Preservation Grants that I think your guests that you mentioned earlier are here for, if you would like to hear about that.
Sure. Let's have Mr. Mack. Mr. Mack, tell us what's on the agenda here for the Maryland Commission on African American History and
this
Culture.
Item 19.
Item 19, and thank you very, very much for your service.
Thank you, Governor. On the agenda today, we have with us Laura Anderson Wright, representing the Odd Fellows Lodge in Sandy Springs. That reconstruction of that lodge and preserving that lodge. We also have with us Clay Washington from representing the Cunard School on Eastern Shore, and Noel Quinton representing the Santo Domingo Rosenwald School. So I would like to bring, oh, they're here, they're forward. But on behalf of the Maryland Commission on African American History and Culture, in partnership with the Maryland Historical Trust, we administer this program for the three people that you see behind us. GOSHI supports this project, the Governor's Office of Community Initiatives, in support of the Maryland Commission, made it possible for us to be standing here today, and we appreciate that very much.
Tell us a little bit about the project.
The projects are capital projects.
So it's a number of them.
It's a number of them. Each one represents a separate project. There are a total of 16 projects. These are the first three of those 16 that projects for last year is being administered by MHC, the Maryland Historical Trust. The Oddfellows Lodge is the last remaining building in Montgomery County that was built by African Americans some years ago. And I would like to ask...
Who wants to speak for the Oddfellows?
An odd lady.
Laura Anderson Wright will speak for the Oddfellows.
Thank you. I'm so appreciative of being here today, and I want to use my opportunity to thank the state, to thank the Board of Public Works for the foresight in providing this very important capital grant program. I actually represent two entities, the Sandy Springs Slave Museum and African Art Gallery, in addition to the Odd Fellows Lodge. The founder of the Sandy Springs Slave Museum, Dr. Winston Anderson, my father, couldn't make it here today, so I'm holding the flag for both of them. But as the comptroller talks about the economy and the behavior of the markets and how it impacts us all, I think not just my two projects in the eastern part of the county, but all of the projects that you will see here today and as the program itself continues represent the economic engine that heritage tourism can be. And that is hopefully creating opportunities for people to come to the counties, to spend money, to stay a while, that there's so many things right here in Maryland, both historic and cultural, that our own residents and, of course, people from the nearby region can come and enjoy. Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
And Newell Gwendon will speak to Senator Domingo Rosenwald School.
Good morning, Governor. The Rosenwald School in San Domingo was built in 1919, and thank you for your support. Greatly appreciate all the support of the trust and the board in preserving that building. It will be used as a culture center for our community to instill within our youth the values and the commitment made by previous generations and the sacrifice made to not only value education but also deal with values and the ability to persevere in a great time in our history. And those values is what this building represents to us, and we will use it as an education tool to continue to teach our generations today that simply we seem to have a void between family values and our rich culture that our ancestors had. And when this building and other buildings like it were constructed, particularly in the arena of providing education to African Americans. So I thank you.
Thank you. What is a Rosenwald School?
The Rosenwald School is a project with Booker T. Washington and Julius Rosenwald, who at the time was the chief executive officer of Sears and Roebuck. And as an effort to provide education for African Americans in the southern part of the United States, he set up a fund where, through partnership with Booker T. Washington, the Rosenwald Fund would contribute certain funds to the building of schools. And very interesting, there was a partnership of three components, with the Rosenwald Fund providing some money, the community providing some money and resources, and the state or county where the school located provided some money for the construction of these buildings. So in Wacomico County, where I'm from, there were seven schools built, and there were some, I think, approximately 250 built in the state of Maryland. But the important thing I mentioned there was this partnership that existed that included the community, the people themselves, the Rosenwald Fund, and the county to cause these schools to be constructed. And in our school, we find that people as early as 1918 donated the land, donated labor, the lumber for the building of the school. And so it's that dedication of the people that were committed to education for the kids and the children is what we're trying to use as an educational vehicle why this building should be preserved and teaching values and family and culture.
This is San Domingo, like San Domingo Creek?
No, San Domingo Creek is actually in near St. Michael's. Truly, our community being designated San Domingo, we believe that that name emanates from the revolution in Haiti, Dominican Republic in 1779, and it carries on as a sign that African Americans use to protect themselves or signal to white people to stay away. So we really can't prove that, but we believe that a lot of people that came in that part of the county, that part of the state, actually came from the Caribbean.
Interesting.
And so that name is stayed with that little community of an African-American community that we trace back to 1820.
That's great.
Yes.
That's
thank
very
you.
Cool.
Yes, sir.
Where did the name, I wonder where the name San Domingo Creek came from in St.
Michael's? No, we believe it's very similar. We find that a lot of people who traveled the Chesapeake from the Caribbean came up the Chesapeake waterways, and many of them were mariners or sailors from the Caribbean. And so that designation of that revolution, which was the first successful revolution of black people, designation continued for years as the way small freed African-American communities protected themselves. And even in our community, we're sort of never has been incorporated, but it was always sort of separate and apart. People very independent, self-sufficient, and great pride in having a community with those two institutions surviving, education and religion. I tell the kids today, I said, gee, when I was growing up, our parents knew we were always in one or two places. We're either in church or we're in school.
That's good history. So San Domingo was a way of, don't tread on me, huh?
Yes, exactly. Yes, sir.
I was the comptroller.
Exactly. Yes, sir, that's exactly.
Okay.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I, too, want to thank the state legislature and its commission, Maryland Historic Trust, for all the work it's putting these grants together. I represent a grassroots organization out of Queen Anne's County, Center of Maryland, that's trying to preserve a piece of African-American history. The Kennard High School, which I was a graduate of, not the original school, by the way, not quite that old, was built in 1936. And it was the first and only African-American secondary school in Queen Anne's County. And like these Rosenwald schools, there were a few of them, and only probably one in every county. And too bad that a lot of them have been bulldozed, are not being used today in any fashion. We were fortunate that the county leased us this building for 99 years in 1996, and we started a grassroots campaign to fix this old school. After about 10,000 chicken dinners and fish dinners, we were able to stabilize this building in 2006. We've since strategized a new way to raise funds and to also to go after larger grants that would help us restore this building in completion. And by the way, I got sticker shock when I found out what it would cost. But we believe that it could be done, and we've embarked on a campaign to make that happen. At this point, I feel like I'm part of a surgical team made up of engineers and contractors and architects, easement overseers like Maryland Historical Trust, this great commission. But what we've done is try to breathe life back into not just an old building, but a body of history. And when we pulled the skin back and started to operate on this building, we found there was cancerous decay and rot. We've been able to address some of those issues, and we hope that by the fall of this, end of the fall of this year, we will have put a new skin on this building. And we're here today because we've applied for a project, a grant for a project that will also start the interior work in this building. This project was set up to restore the old doors in this building. That sounds like kind of a mundane thing, but it's not, because these doors, like the doors in this building, represent the personality of this building. And we're so grateful that you guys have put us on point, hopefully, to get this done. And we're on the way. We're far from finished, but we're on the way. So this will probably not be the last time you'll see me. And hopefully, it will not be the last time I see you. But I thank you for your confirmation of the worth of this project by voting on this grant today. Thank you, and God bless.
Thank you.
Governor, you can see from the passion of the three people that just spoke what this grant program has created in the African-American community. We hear this everywhere we go in the state. And I'm so happy to have with us today Ann Range from the Maryland Historical Trust, who is the administrator of the grant.
I just want to thank you very much for your support of this grant program. in, as Chairman Mack said, in all the communities that we go to, all the groups that we meet with, we are just so warmly received, and we're so pleased to be able to assist these projects that otherwise, in the absence of other capital funding for historic preservation, they might not be able to restore. So thank you very much.
And I would be remiss if I did not bring Dr. Jones before you to offer her comments and thanks for the support that you're giving us.
Good morning, Mr. Governor, Mr. Comptroller. I just want to echo the sentiments that you've heard so far. This has been a very successful and robust collaboration with just a sampling of the entities that you see here today. We're excited that we have completed round two. The applications for the second round are in, and they are equally compelling, and we're just rearing to go, and hope to come back to you at a later time with more successful partnership stories to share with you.
Thank you.
A big shout out to Izzy and the Twin Tonys for for their support, because without them, we would not be able to move as fast as we are moving. So thank you so much.
Thank
very
you.
Much.
It feels like a radio show today. Mr. Comptroller, any questions?
No.
Okay.
Great project.
Well, thank you all for your passion and for your commitment and the hard work you do to make our history live in the present. So with that, the Comptroller moves approval of the items on the Secretary's agenda, unless there are any other questions on the Secretary's agenda, seconded by yours truly. All in favor, signal by saying aye. Aye. All opposed, nay. The ayes have it. Thank you all. We now move on to the Department of Natural Resources real property agenda.
Good morning, Governor. Mr. Comptroller, Meredith Lasbury for the Department of Natural Resources. We have three items on the agenda today. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions?
I just had a question about the items of where you reserve abandoned land. I understand you have a statutory limit there. I guess it says the land has to be abandoned for 20 years without the owner or the taxes being paid. I handle the unclaimed property in my agency that from financial institutions, and there's a three-year time frame where it's turned over to the state. I wonder whether you might consider asking the legislature to address that statutory 20-year time frame, because it seems like a long time when nobody is either using, owning, or paying taxes on property.
That's a great suggestion. We refer to this certificate of preservation as the Lost Souls Program. This legislation was passed in 2007. It allows the department to claim this abandoned land. These are in holdings within many of our public parks, mm-hmm. and it allows us to create public access. The legislation actually sunsets at the end of 2012, so we're hoping that it could become permanent through an act of the legislature, and perhaps they could look at the timing. I believe that the time frame is actually based on some of the principles of adverse possession, so I think that's why the 20-year provision is in there. But it's something that certainly could
but
be looked at.
But there are big chunks of property that, I mean, not huge, but 20 acres and 30 acres. So
exactly.
How many total acres are there in the reserved?
Well, in this group that you're seeing today, there's a total of about 45 acres that we're requesting.
Uh-huh.
We've identified, I believe, up to 300 acres within our state parks that we will be seeking certificates of reservation for. And we've already you've already seen two of these, and this was last year.
Good. Well, it's a very reasonable course of action, but I agree. I'm glad you agree that the 20 years is perhaps should be looked at.
Absolutely. We'll take a look at that, and we're very grateful for the ability to secure these lands for the state at no cost.
Good. I would move approval of that
Great.
Agenda.
The Comptroller moves approval, seconded by yours truly. All in favor, signal by saying aye. Aye. All opposed? The ayes have it. We move on now to the Department of Budget and Management.
Good morning, Governor, Mr. Comptroller.
Eloise, you've changed.
Roman, Department of Budget and Management. We have 11 items on our agenda today. Item 11 is a supplemental item, and items 1, 3, and 8 have been revised. I'm happy to take any questions that you have.
I have a question about item
Mr. 5. Mr. Comptroller.
Item 5. Is Dr. Lieber here?
I think Dr. Smealy from the State Department of Education is here.
Oh, good. Well, whoever's here.
Item 5, just while he's coming up. Oh, Dr. Lieber is here. While they're coming up, item 5 is just a request for retroactive approval of a contract to conduct a biennial survey.
Right. I'm going to support the item, and I have no problem with the item, but it does give me an opportunity to bring up a related or another issue that's been front and center for me over the last month because it's been so abnormally hot, and that is the fact that our children are going to return to school in just a couple of weeks, and I continue to be amazed and disturbed by the fact that in the year 2011, there are a small number of jurisdictions in the state where the majority of school classrooms are not air-conditioned. And it's no great secret what I'm referring to because I've gotten a lot of the information from Dr. Lieber at my request, and thank you for being up front. But the fact that 54% of Baltimore County schools' classrooms are not air-conditioned is surprising to me, and 50% of the city's schools are not air-conditioned. I'm not assigning blame for those conditions, but I think it's just unacceptable for our school kids, particularly given what Mother Nature is serving up to us, to have the kids in these kinds of conditions. I mean, we've had 24 people die this year because of heat-related illnesses. Hundreds have been hospitalized. I mean, just imagine if we were meeting in a brick building today without the benefit of air conditioning and sit there for 7, 8, 9 hours. I think it'd be a hard experience. And obviously, those of us in the echelons, high echelons of government, we don't have those conditions. And I doubt you could find a school administration official or board of education person or anybody in the state of Maryland or any of those jurisdictions that doesn't have air conditioning. Yet 54% of the classrooms in Baltimore County have no air conditioning. So, Dr. Lieber, obviously you're one of our exceptional public servants, and if you want to give me any perspective on how I understand you only respond to jurisdictions' requests, but I'd be truly grateful if you and perhaps the Department of Education could share information for me about how we can improve, I guess, this hazardous, I really think you have to describe it as a hazardous situation given the temperatures that we're seeing outside. And the kids are, I think, going back to school in a couple of weeks. How did we get here and what can we do?
Well, thank you for the emphasis that you're putting on this issue. It's one that we also emphasize. My understanding is that both Baltimore City and Baltimore County, under the current superintendents and the local administration, local government, are also focusing on this issue. And this is correcting a backlog of deficiencies that where air conditioning was not a priority at certain points. Baltimore County is undertaking the renovation of 20 high schools. It will require an enormous amount of capital investment. All of those high schools will have air conditioning. In addition, we expect to see specific requests this fall in the capital improvement program for air conditioning in schools in Baltimore County. Understand that if they try to undertake the air conditioning of all schools now, including those high schools, it would be about $400 million. Baltimore City has given a figure of about $230 million to do air conditioning in all schools. So just from a fiscal point of view, it's beyond anybody's reach to undertake that right now. Air conditioning, complete HVAC renovation, I understand, goes for about $80 a square foot, according to construction sources that I rely on. That means that for an elementary school, it's somewhere between $6 and $7 million. For a middle school, about $11 million. For a high school, it can be $16 million. Westminster High School in Carroll County was installed air conditioning for $26 million So these are not small projects, and they affect the operation of the school. But what we want to see is a plan for undertaking this, for carrying out the work over a long period, recognizing that fiscal constraints are there and that there are other priorities that have to be addressed along with air conditioning. So in the long term, we hope the situation will be corrected. I think it does depend on maintaining a high level of state funding over the course of a number of years. The local governments depend critically on the state.
You mean a number of more years?
Yes, a number of more years, exactly. It helps them to reduce the backlog of their own deficiencies by taking care of major projects. It frees up local money to address some of the smaller issues that can be sometimes done through a systemic renovation at the local level. But also, we're investigating alternative funding and financing on models that have been used in the United Kingdom and Canada and Australia. And we think there's a lot of promise in these methods to address a broader scope of projects within the resources that we already have, we, meaning the state and the local government.
What would they be, energy conservation?
It goes beyond that, Governor. Energy conservation is being used now. There's a model called Design, Build, Finance, Operate, or Design, Build, Finance, Operate, Maintenance, which has been used very successfully in England, Scotland, Northern Ireland, Irish Republic, Alberta. Ontario is using it, but not for schools, and New South Wales are the jurisdictions I'm familiar with, where the essentially a capital cost is turned into a long-term operating cost, which includes the maintenance and operations of the building as the revenue stream that repays the financing to undertake the capital cost. And they use parameters to compare this approach, public private finance initiative, it's called, to a public sector comparator, which means if you did it under the normal financing mechanisms, what value for money are you getting by using the private sector? And the reports that I'm getting back are that there is considerable value for money that's achieved.
Great.
And Alberta claims to have saved $97 million by using repeat designs and by using this finance initiative.
Did they have to get out crowbars in order to separate these capital decisions away from their local school boards?
No, the school boards were very interested because otherwise they couldn't do the projects.
That's great. It's been my experience with school boards and school CEOs. They would far rather spend a week looking at new building designs and being capital planners than focusing on, you know, the other thing, because it's almost like recess time for them. They like to look at the capital plans. I mean, I don't mean that out of any disrespect. I mean, but it's so hard politically, given the way we try to keep the politicians out of the education enterprise, except to constantly ask them to raise revenues and pump more money in. Yeah. It's so hard to take over. I mean, even the county executives. I mean, Mr. Comptroller, I applaud your empathy and your focus on this issue. When I was mayor of Baltimore, with the dollars we had, far less in those years from the state than the dollars now, we had ran a whole campaign called Believe in Our Schools. We got private contractors to come in. We realized that air conditioning buildings that were built in the time of the first Alessandro, sound like emperors of Rome, don't they? The times of the first Alessandro was cost prohibitive, but people like Bill Strieber went in and figured out a way that they could air condition a floor with window units so that at least during testing time, kids could rotate through in that fashion. And we made a lot of strides. But I hope you come up with... I would encourage you to fast forward these things, and I'm not opposed to, and would in fact, let me not speak like a lawyer, I would embrace efforts by the legislature to reward, mandate, encourage school boards to find new ways to more rapidly improve learning conditions for our kids and our teachers. I mean, this old model that you must own it, you must build it, you must operate it. There are very few endeavors like that. And police are sometimes like that, too. Police and educators believe that because they are police or because they are educators, they are best qualified to run their own IT department, run their own buildings, do their own HVAC, and do all these other things that are totally outside the discipline so that's so desperately needed by the rest of us and that they were originally called to. I'm going on too long on your line of questioning. See, in second term, you get to speak like this freely without worrying about how somebody's going to misconstrue it and put it in an attack ad later.
No, Governor, I think your comments are exactly on point. And Baltimore City, obviously, they have special challenges there as far as the school system. What I find hard to believe is Baltimore County, where 54% of the classrooms are not air-conditioned. 85% of the classrooms in the state are air-conditioned. But for some reason, the county is not moved in that direction. And I understand the long-term costs of central air conditioning, but if I could just give a helpful suggestion, I'd be happy to pay for the U-Haul truck to go down to the local air conditioning appliance store in Towson and other places in Baltimore County, pick up some window boxes, some units, and put them in so that come the end of August, the kids have a little bit of cool air and at least have a safe environment. I guarantee you that there isn't a school administrator in Baltimore County that doesn't have an air conditioned office. Guarantee it. And, what about the kids? And so I appreciate your attention to this in the long term, and I'm very supportive. Whatever the governor is, legislative leaders come up with, I think that's great. But you're right, those are expensive, and they're long-term central air conditioning projects. Let's just go out and buy some air conditioners.
It is a change
window
of
units.
A change of focus that I think has taken place over the last couple of years, but it takes a long time to roll out. Just to go to your point about the window units, we call them window shakers, often the electrical system doesn't have sufficient capacity to support a unit in every classroom, and so that becomes a problem.
That's why Secretary Collins is here. He's going to help you get that hooked up. But I appreciate this. I didn't mean to take the State Board of Education, but you guys aren't involved in the school construction. But obviously, you have an interest in common sense improvements for kids. And any data you have on how hard it is for kids to study when it's 100 degrees in the, or 95 degrees in the classroom, feel free to send us.
Absolutely, and that doesn't take a lot of data. I think, as you've commented, Mr. Controller, it's common sense. When we are under really adverse weather conditions, learning is affected. We work with the Department of Health and Mental Hygiene, for example, to issue weather alerts and work with local school systems to do whatever mitigation they can and provide them with advice. But as you point out, when it's 100 degrees, learning is affected. So we'll continue to work with the, we're very grateful of Dr. Lieber and his position, work with local school systems, boards, and superintendents to move us forward as quickly as they can. Thank you for, I would echo Dr. Lieber, thank you for raising this issue.
Excellent. Thank you. Governor, thank you. I do have a question on item 9. Is that the health benefit exchange?
Dr. Trustee is here from the Health Department. Item 9 is a request to create 3 positions under the rule of 100, which allows the board to create positions during the course of the year. They would be to support the health exchange.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary, for being here. I obviously don't have any problem with the federal legislation nor with the health exchange or the creation of these positions. I'm fine on that. And I had a very good conversation with you about the benefits of the exchange. I do have some questions about the way in which this exchange is going to reach its potential without unnecessary cost to the taxpayers. Mm-hmm. And I take it the legislature created this exchange as an independent public entity. What's going on there? Why isn't it under the supervision of your agency?
I think the discussion that the legislature had was between two models. I don't think that there was a serious consideration about making it a state agency. I think it was between having it as a fully independent nonprofit and having it as a hybrid. And the legislature went with the hybrid model, which has a 9-member board. I'm the chair of the board, so we're pretty involved. Also on the board is the executive director of the Healthcare Commission and the head of the Insurance Administration, the commissioner. Mm-hmm. And then there's 6 non-government employees. So that sort of creates the part of the hybrid nature. There's, rules, that very specific rules that pertain to the civil service and hiring and, you know, how that's done. And then there's, rules that the legislature or the, standards legislature set up around procurement. And we'll be coming by and briefing you on where that stands. The board has met multiple times now. We have a terrific board. We have George's Benjamin is on the board. If you remember, Dr. Benjamin was the Secretary of Health. And we have some terrific board members. And they have taken some steps in certain areas. They have approved a general procurement policy that was recommended by the Attorney General's office. They have also approved an initial structure for the hiring of the key staff of the exchange, and we've recruited for an executive director, and then there's the key members of that person's team. The other major thing that's going on this year, as prescribed by the legislature, is that there are 6 mandated studies that have to be done, one of them pertaining right to the financial sustainability of the exchange that have to be done by December 23rd and presented back to the legislature. So we are now working on those studies. We have 4 advisory committees with about 18 people on them from around Maryland. Each will be advising as we put together these studies, and they eventually go back from the exchange board to the legislature.
Okay, so I understand the new relationship with your agency is basically determined by your membership on the board and the chairmanship of that board.
That's right.
Okay, that's reassuring to me. What have you done to assure that we aren't going to, as we begin to develop this new exchange, that we don't have some kind of mission creep, that we have a responsible fiscal control over what the board is studying and suggesting be implemented?
Sure. I think the most important thing there's been a lot of, public review and discussion of this since the governor, set up a healthcare reform coordinating council right after the healthcare reform law was signed. And coming out of that, there was a real understanding that the taxpayers through the regular revenue system would not be paying for the exchange. And in fact, there really are 2 phases. One is the first phase, which we're in now, where the federal government is paying for 100% of the startup costs for the exchange. And so we have so far had $1 million in a planning grant, and then there is the first phase of an establishment grant, which we have submitted that establishment grant request for roughly $40 million. Has to do with mainly startup costs related to the IT. That's to be able to get the money. And then in 2015, it has to be self-sustaining. So that's where that study the legislature set up that, where would there be the potentially fees assessed for people using the exchange, for example, that would allow it to be self-sustaining. So the board has in mind, and I can say this as the chair, that this can't be, a sprawling enterprise, because we're going to have to pay for it itself. And ultimately, we have to make sure that the exchange is, succeeding. And to succeed, it has to have people who are getting insurance through the exchange. And if we have too many administrative costs that, cause fees in all sorts of different directions, it'll increase the price of insurance through the exchange. It'll create a problem for the success of the exchange. So we're starting with a very small staff. We're going to be, thinking about how to, keep it manageable through the whole process, because in not too long, it's going to have to succeed on its own.
Well, thank you, Mr. Secretary, and that's also reassuring. And I'm glad you brought these 3 positions before the Board of Public Works. Moving forward, do you anticipate that the exchange will bring future procurement actions before this board?
I ask that because I read a summary of the new legislation which states that the new exchange is not subject to the state's finance and procurement article, which obviously memorializes the role that the BPW has in procurement. So I
think, you know, my view is that we need to work collaboratively with the Board of Public Works for, you know, the challenges, because the expertise in procurement, there's a tremendous amount of expertise on your staff and with the Board of Public Works. And I don't view it as a, you know, entirely separate enterprise. On the other hand, we need, I think, and I think the legislature saw the flexibility that the structure provides may be necessary, that certain procurements wouldn't go through the Board of Public Works. But that's something that we want to be transparent about with you and with others. You know, right now, for example, we had this deadline of December 23rd to do these legislative studies, and they're relatively small procurements going on for technical support for those that the board has authorized under the procurement policy set out by the Attorney General staff. So I think as you get to bigger procurements, I think it becomes a more challenging issue, and something that we should be in communication about.
Yeah, let me just urge that it needs to be much more than communication. Those big, whatever big contracts you enter into, need to come before this board, because we have a history over the last 100 years where independent, quote, flexible approaches to procurement have resulted not in savings to the taxpayer, but all sorts of problems. And I'm not suggesting any of that would happen. I'm just saying that when you're you get outside the process of that's been set up, you really, as well-intentioned as the legislature and you are, you can create an environment where big mistakes are made and people are put in awkward positions. So I would strongly recommend to the legislative, the studies are not a particular concern to me, but to the extent there are big contracts being approved by this exchange, they should come before this Board of Public Works. And that's my opinion.
Great. Well, we'll definitely have a chance to talk about that. We're looking at all the different issues involved.
Anything else on this matter or any other matters? Are we on DDM?
And this is a big priority for us, because if there's anything that I lie awake at night, which I don't do a lot, but if it is, it's the health care situation. We want affordable, accessible health care, but how we're going to pay for that, and we're all trying to get the same thing, but, you know, for example, told that, making medical records electronic are going to, you know, have huge cost savings. And it makes sense. I open up the paper and I read that our Maryland hospitals are bleeding, hemorrhaging their cash to pay for these electronic records. And maybe it ends up saving us money. But you know what I'm talking about. There are good intentions and good proposals, and we all want the goals, but
no problem. That's nice.
How do we pay for it? So that's why I'm a little concerned that this process is outside of this body, and I hope that you and the legislature can figure out how you bring those contracts before us, albeit in a voluntary way, I guess. But I think they should come before the board for approval.
What agenda item was this again?
Is that a 9GM, 9 on DBM? It is the creation of 3 positions for the health exchange.
Okay. So this is the electronic health exchange. This is not the same thing.
This is the health care reform.
This is the health care reform health exchange that the brokers are very interested in,
yes,
everybody else,
exactly,
and small business.
So we use it, right. So
gotcha. We sometimes use those terms interchangeably.
Exactly.
And
there's
not
the HECS and the HICS.
The what?
The HEX and the HICS. The health exchange is sometimes called the HEX and the
HICS. Well, it leads to an enormous amount of confusion. Yeah. I tell you, in this in this new world of ours, you almost need a glossary of terms to keep up with what the hell they're talking about on energy sustainability, environmental sustainability, or financial sustainability. And then when you get into this, it's the health insurance exchange, and then the health IT exchange,
right.
And then the, you know, exchange of new directors to head up the HMH exchange. And who's on first? So this is the thing that the brokers are very much interested in, and the small businesses and all of that that we're mandated to do under the Affordable Health Care Act, and what this group is charged with figuring out. This is more on the accessibility rather than the interoperability of coordinated care.
Correct. We have to establish by January 1st, 2014, a functioning health insurance marketplace called an exchange in Maryland, or the federal government comes in and takes it over. So one of the reasons that the procurement, you know, policy was worked on this way by the legislature is the acknowledgement that the timelines are fierce.
Right.
By January 1st, 2013, we have to start passing tests that HHS puts in front of us, or else they say we're pulling the plug on
Maryland. Else we default in the
And because of many aspects of Maryland which are unique, I can tell you across everyone, the brokers, the hospitals, the doctors, everyone who's worked on this, there is complete agreement that we would like to manage our own destiny here. And that is made possible if we can hit these deadlines. So that's basically why this is a big project. And I can promise you that if you're lying awake at night, you should feel free to call me, because I'm probably up wondering about some of these things myself.
I'll share with you, Mr. Comptroller, that when he first came on board, Dr. Sharfstein said to me, I've got to tell you, I've looked at this health care reform, and if you're not totally committed to finding a way to make it work, you've already condemned your state to failure. So I'm glad you stay awake at night worrying about this. I'm glad both of you do. That allows me to stay awake worrying about other things as we divide our energies. There's this great poem by Wendell Berry called The Peace of Wild Things. Can you pull that up on the internet? I may do a reading of that shortly, but I think the best time for it would probably be after the Department of Information and Technology agenda. So,
move approval for this.
The Comptroller moves approval of the Department of Budget Management agenda items. Seconded by the Comptroller. All in favor, signal by saying aye. Aye. Oh, here it is. Oh, here it is. When despair for the world grows in me and I wake in the night at the least sound, in fear of what my life and my children's lives may be, I go and lie down where the wood drake rests in his beauty on the water and the great heron feeds. I come into the peace of wild things who do not tax their lives with forethought of grief. I come into the presence of still water, and I feel above me the day-blind stars, waiting with their light. For a time, I rest in the grace of the world, and am free.
Boy, if there's ever a better time for that poem, given what's happened the last week. Thank you for sharing that.
I haven't fallen back on that one a lot. Makes you breathe deeper, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Thank you. You like that one, too.
I do.
Was that in your save file? How do you find it?
No, I like the poems. Thank you.
Okay, University System of Maryland.
Good morning. Joe Evans, representing the University System of Maryland. We have 8 items on the agenda today. Here to answer any questions.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Fisk, Governor, if I could just ask a question about item 5S.
Okay, I'd like to bring up Valerie Rolandelli.
Yeah, good, because that's a $45 million request that I had great difficulty understanding what we're going to be spending $45 million on.
Good morning. I'm Valerie Rolandelli from the University System, and I was the procurement officer on this. What this is a group of consulting contracts. We have what is called ERP systems, which handles all of our back office systems, for the administration, for finances, for the HR system, and primarily for our student systems. And so these systems need to be maintained and kept in order so that our students can apply, that their records are kept current, et cetera. And these, in any information technology world, we need to oftentimes upgrade or bring in experts to help us for particular items related to that. And 10 of the university system schools use PeopleSoft, and so that oftentimes takes consulting help.
Okay. So we're going to approve $45 million in spending. You have a group of contractors.
13
that are there. I guess my concern is that in your backup material, you indicate that some of these $45 million can, in effect, be bid.
Correct.
To one of these companies.
That's correct. Oftentimes,
I think the language is one or more.
Correct.
Why isn't it two or more?
Oftentimes we'll look at all of them, but some of these people are niche players, particularly just trainers, and not all of the consultants offer all of the expertise that we need.
Okay. Well, that doesn't make sense to me, that you have a process where you put together a group of companies that you're going to bid the $45 million to, and they're not going to come back to us. We're not going to see these after we vote today, I take it. But yet some of that $45 million is going to be bid, in quotation marks, to a single niche company. That doesn't make sense to me.
It's rare that we would only look at one, only if there was a special or unique need or a specific expertise in consulting that one of these firms would offer to us.
Well,
but in most of the cases, there will be more than one firm that's looked at and proposals received for task orders.
It just doesn't look good. I guess what you're saying is that it's only going to be used rarely, so... But I'm going to go along with it, but I'd request that if you do solicit a proposal from just one company, as rare as that might be,
okay,
that you come back to the board and tell us about it.
Okay, we'll be glad to do that.
Make sure in a state as technologically rich as ours, which is as many IT businesses as ours, that there's the reflective diversity and these projects.
Absolutely.
Okay. Move approval.
Controller moves approval. University System of Maryland items seconded by yours truly. All in favor signal by saying aye. All opposed, nay. The ayes have it. We move on now to the Department of Information Technology.
Good morning, Governor, Mr. Comptroller, Elliot Schlanger, Department of Information and Technology. We have six items on the agenda this morning, including supplemental 6IT. I would like to call your attention to item 3IT, which is a proposed contract with NIC USA, who will provide e-government portal services to the state under a self-funded model. And if the board would like, we are prepared to offer a brief to presentation this morning on NIC and what they will do for the state. And we can also, of course, answer any questions on any other items.
How long is brief?
We can make it less than 5 minutes. Fair deal?
I feel badly doing this without the treasurer.
The treasurer's the one that won the presentation.
She was dying to hear this.
Yeah.
How about we approve it and then you bring it back at the next meeting when the company, because it's not going away. Tell us in a nutshell what this is.
Okay. Well, as you know, we do a pretty good job with our online services. As a matter of fact, in 2008, the Center for Digital Government awarded us, say, ninth in the U.S. in that same group in 2000.
Ninth in the U.S. for?
For best portal and online services. And in
services, and by this you don't mean procurements where companies build bid to build bridges or provide IT services. You mean this online services provided to citizens?
Government to business and government to citizens.
So licensing of businesses.
Right. Sale of data to insurance companies and the like.
Gotcha. And as well as driver's license or registration of the things you're able to do online or getting something from the Department of Assessments and Taxation.
Correct.
Gotcha.
Correct. And just like to point out, in 2010, that same group gave us a grade of B. Now, you, Governor,
2003 got a B?
Yeah. We are insulted because, you know, we are a AAA state.
And I'm insulted by B.
Right. So am I. And I think so is everyone in this room. So we really need to think out of the box and come out with a way that we can have our online services and web portal equal that AAA rating that we know we should be at. And so we propose that we're going to partner with NIC, who is the leading expert in this business. As a matter of fact, they do self-funded portals in 24 states. And when they come in the door, they bring 20 years' experience and approximately 7,500 e-government applications that we can leverage. And the beauty of the self-funded model is it is done without any cost to the agencies in the state. And the way that is done is approximately 20% of the applications that they will implement do carry a convenience fee. These fees, again, are only assessed to those who choose to use the self-serve option. And that funding is successfully driving the 80% of the applications that don't have fees.
What are some of the other states?
If I may, I have a map. For those of us who are expert in geography, we could probably name all those states.
There's the Virginians, huh?
Good.
Okay. Well,
I move approval and please give the PowerPoint to the treasurer.
All right. Comptroller moves approval, seconded by yours truly. These are on all. Do you have any questions on other do-it items?
No.
So on the entire Department of Information Technology agenda item, seconded by the governor, all in favor signal by saying aye. Aye. All opposed, nay. The ayes have it. And
Thank
we
you.
Hope you will return with your full PowerPoint for the treasurer, who's very excited about this.
We will absolutely do that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Who are we doing up now?
Transportation.
Department of Transportation.
Good morning, Governor, Mr. Comptroller. For the record, Darryl Mobley representing MDOT. MDOT is presenting 24 items today, and item 25 is being withdrawn. For the record, items 1, 3, 9, 21, and 22 have been revised.
Any questions? Department of Transportation, moved by the Comptroller, seconded by me. All in favor, signal by saying aye. Aye. All opposed, nay. The ayes have it. We move on now to the Department of General Services.
Good morning, Governor. Matt, Mr. Comptroller. The Department of General Services has 28 items on our agenda, including one supplemental. Item 4 has been revised. We'd be glad to answer any questions you have at this time. Governor, before we start, may I introduce the new Deputy Secretary for my department?
Sure.
DeAndre Lansons, please stand up. Is the new Secretary, Deputy Secretary for me. As you know, Governor, we've been looking for one for a long time. She finally, the right person came
is
along.
Ms. Lansom, L-A-N...
L-A-N-C-E-L-L-I-N. Excellent.
Great. Come on up to the microphone. Tell us where you came from. Thank you.
Good morning. I actually came from Department of Transportation. I was
Poaching.
But tell them where you started, DeAndrea.
I started up here on the second floor. I used to be the director to the Board of Public Works for Governor Glenn Denning quite some time ago. So I've been around state government for almost 15 years now.
Don't let that hold you back.
Not at all. And I'm happy to be a part of DGS. I do miss Department of Transportation.
What did you do at Transportation?
I was deputy administrator for operations. So I managed all of the field services, all the 25 MVA locations and the VEEP locations and the call centers and school bus safety.
How are they going to get on without you?
They have some good people working for them.
Mm-hmm. That's great. Yeah. Mr. Fine. Collins looks very, very happy.
No, I don't. And I want to thank Secretary Staley, who was very cooperative in making this exchange.
She was.
And she's been very supportive to this. And we're just excited to have DeAndrea Hull with us, Governor. And she just brings a wealth of talent that we sorely need.
Great.
Thank you, Mrs. Secretary.
Thank you. Mr. Controller, are you okay with these?
I have a question on 28.
28.
Item 28. Yes, sir. Mr. Controller, this is the health laboratory that we introduced at the last meeting. We're bringing it back today with the one question that you asked us to respond to, but we're happy to answer any questions you have on this item. We have a number of people in the audience who are experts on this particular activity.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. And we did approve this project 2 years ago. I think at least we started the approval. And I remain supportive of the project, but I think it's imperative that we understand exactly what we're doing here and the implications of this lease agreement. It's my understanding and that of my staff that this lease agreement is defined as taxpayer-supported debt and must therefore be counted against our state's benchmark of debt affordability.
So let me ask Mr. Gaines to come up, Mr. Comptroller, to address that issue. That is not the understanding that we have in working out this item with the Treasurer's Office. So, Mr. Gaines, you've been intimately involved with this.
Yes, it is a 20-year lease. The HMH will be leasing the property from Medco. It is structured as a capital lease, and because of that, has been reviewed by the Debt Affordability Committee, will count against the state's debt.
Okay, so for the sake of people listening and at home, I guess, we have our own debt ceiling in Maryland. We've read so much about the feds. We have our own debt ceiling.
Correct.
It's something we do voluntarily. We limit our tax-supported debt to 4% of personal income and tax-supported debt service to 8% of revenues. And with this taxpayer-supported lab coming online with $184.8 million in capital lease payments being added to the debt load, I think the Treasurer's own projections, as communicated in a May 26 letter to Governor O'Malley and the presiding offices of the legislature, would have the state of Maryland hitting that 8% debt ceiling in fiscal year 2016 and temporarily exceeding the ceiling in fiscal year 2017. And that doesn't include other projects that currently are not classified as capital debt but could be in the very near future. We obviously have had some attention paid to the State Center project, which I believe after GASB speaks in September or October, is going to have to be considered fit under the debt affordability level. So I guess the point here is that I support this project, but I think it's uncomfortable that we're this close to the debt ceiling. And I hope that we reexamine the capital spending commitments that we have and figure out what we can and what we can't live with, because we're getting dangerously close to those limits. Well, this one, we're basically exceeding it, as far as I can tell, at least according to the Treasurer's chart. And I just think that, given the downgrade of the U.S. government and the increased scrutiny of the rating agencies, obviously, for AAA states like us that have a close connection to the feds, I think it's something that we need to be extremely cautious about. Do you have something new to tell me that this is...
Well, we agree that...
Not what I think it is?
Well, we do agree that caution is the order of the day. However, this is an essential use and function of the state in providing public health needs to the citizens of the state of Maryland. The current facility that they're in is sorely in need of being replaced. Highly dysfunctional systems are in just disrepair, millions of dollars of deferred maintenance, and we need a state-of-the-art facility. I can't speak as well as Dr. Sharfstein on it, and maybe I'll let him speak to that as well. But based on the letter from Secretary Cobb, we believe that this essential need and function of the state does fit under the cap. There is 1 year, 2017, where it marginally exceeds. I think the Treasurer's Office has run new numbers that demonstrate that these lease payments will fall under the cap. Deputy Treasurer is here this morning to speak to that.
That's news, I guess, because I agree with you. It's an important project, but these debt limit ceilings that the Capital Debt Affordability Committee has established with the legislature and the second floor, these are very important also. So if we, every time we have a good project, we blow through the ceiling, that's not a good dynamic that we're setting up. It's kind of reminiscent of what, in a very, 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 very small way, what some of the problems in Washington are. But please, is there more information that's coming out?
Good morning, Governor. Mr. Comptroller. Please excuse me, I'm getting over a summer cold and some laryngitis. Yes,
you
have one.
For the record, please.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's Bernadette Bennett, Chief Deputy Treasurer for the State Treasurer's Office.
Thank you.
As you know, CDAC begins to meet in August, and it goes through September, looking at numbers to produce the report at the end of September. In the process of doing that, our first meeting with the committee will be on Friday. We have completed our first run of new affordability analysis numbers that will be given out on Friday. What we have determined is that right now, with the new numbers that are run, now these do not include the new revenue projections that will come out by the Board of Revenue estimates in September, but it includes all other debt issues. And right now, we're projecting that in 2017, we will hit 7.87% versus the original last year's report of over 8%, and it will drop to 7.16% in 2021. Now, the reason for that, there are several reasons for that. One of the reasons is our debt service is down about $22 million compared to the 2010 report. That's because we now have factored in the most recent bond sale we had that just passed. Additionally, last year the legislature passed under Chapter 163 of the laws of 2011 a law that says that for capital debt affordability purposes, that the state does not have to count any cap energy leases where there's a guaranteed energy savings that equal or exceed debt service payments. So that's accounting for about another $13 million in savings that will come off of the debt limits. Additionally, we now have better numbers for the VLTs at Arundel Mills. So the amount last year projected to be spent to finance is down because they've now figured out how many machines they're going to lease purchase versus the ones that will be the payouts that they actually, I think, lease from the manufacturer. And then we also have some transportation debt service down, and there's a few million here and there when Stadium Authorities has an exclusion on their energy leases that we do, and then a few other little miscellaneous items. So right now, the way we're projecting the numbers, we will, with the lab in, and this does include the lab being in, it has the State Center garage out, we will be under the 8%.
Okay, and what happens when you put State Center and the Charles County Jail and all these other wonderful projects that we have considered to be outside of the debt ceiling? What's going to happen when Gaspy says, sorry, states, we don't agree with you on the smoke and mirrors operation, and we want you to correctly classify these as capital debt?
Well, clearly, if we had to put State Center in and if we had to put in the other leases, there is also about $60 million, I believe, that maybe Secretary Collins can clarify, that we do have an outstanding operating leases that would also be brought in. So to the extent that GASB or FASB says the states must include these under their debt limits, I think it would be up to CDAC to go back and then look at those criteria and decide what they were going to do with them, because the original limits, while they are self-imposed, that were set were done years ago and were primarily set just to be on general obligation debt that was issued.
Okay. This, as I understand or try to pierce the wonderful eloquence and elegance in your remarks, basically implies that we're going to go back and raise the limit. And I think that is just, given the climate, outrageous. And I hope that that is not proffered by the legislature or legislative leaders or by the treasurer or by others. It's wrong. It's going to get us in a tremendous amount of difficulty if we open this up, A, to ledger domain on the one hand, or B, just, hey, let's raise the limit.
And I understand, Mr. Comptroller. I'm not proposing we're going to do that, but I'm just saying that once this happens, it is something the CDC will have to look at when it makes its recommendations on the debt limits.
If I could, Governor, just to finish the point, the problem here is that by voting for this project today, which we're going to do, we put ourselves right up there. And I'm not sure about these energy contracts. That sounds, pretty complicated, and maybe it's taken care of in the federal statute. But the point is that we've got these large increasing debt obligations, and we need to be extremely cautious about that, given what's happened in the last week and what could happen in the next foreseeable future. So I hope that we're not going to take the easy road out here and just say, geez, 8%? How about 9%? Or how about 10%? I think it's something we should avoid at all costs, given at least until we're well into the recovery that we all hope will happen down the road. Sorry, Governor, I didn't mean to get down in the weeds there, but it's a, it's something the public looks at and says, geez. You go back and look at it, and all of a sudden you're not breaking through the debt ceiling. You've got all this wiggle room in there, and it just looks at the last minute, when you compare it to the letter that was sent in May, like we are, like the Wizard of Oz, we're back there behind the curtain pushing and pulling. And it's a bad impression. And then the worst impression would be, oh, gee, we were really not happy with the 8% because it's limiting us. Let's change it. And if we were in better times, I think we could at least talk about it, but these are not better times. And, anyway, on that happy note, have a great rest of the week, and I'm happy to move approval, Governor.
Okay. Seconded by yours truly. All in favor, signal by saying aye. All opposed, nay. The ayes have it. And let me just add, I think it's important that we take a deep breath and not catch the contagion going on to the west of us. Several times over the last 5 years, we have raised our own debt ceiling. We've done it in a moderate and responsible way and have maintained a AAA bond rating the entire time. And many of the same new approaches that we've discussed to doing things, especially where real estate is concerned, getting away from the notion that the state must always own the buildings, the state must always operate, the state must always maintain the buildings, and combining this with our drive to reducing energy costs requires that we enter into new types of agreement that are build and lease, because we've decided that those are more fiscally advantageous to us, not that it allows us to skate on payments, but that it allows us over the long term to fulfill the needs that we have for this common safeguarding platform of our state government. So, I don't know, we can have a longer conversation, and no doubt we'll have longer conversations. Mr. Comptroller, I think your cautionary words are well stated and certainly well received, but there is a balance here if we're going to do some of these things in ways that save the people money over the long term.
And just for the record, there were no one-to-one votes today.
That's right. There we go. Hey, thank you. It's Maryland. We figure out a way to make things work.
Thank you.
Thank you. This adjourns our meeting. Do you remember it someday?
Did you say